today where multitasking is the norm and every second counts, one expert dares to challenge the status quo.
Because there really is no such thing as multitasking. That's a myth we tell ourselves. But you know, the sheer act of focusing stopped that context switching and the wasted time.
Join Agile guru Angela as she unveils the art of prioritization that's transforming the landscape of leadership.
No. Something has to be one. Something has to be two. Something has to be three. It all can't be priority, or nothing is.
Experience the power of structured conversations, the discipline of daily check-ins, and the transformative magic of time boxing.
So instead of starting a bunch of things, hang on, let's start finishing and stop starting. And even organizations that aren't going to abandon their classic project management way of working that I've talked to get kind of excited about that notion of having stable teams with clear direction. Instead of making people chase work, bringing the work to the people in the ordered manner.
This is more than just an episode. It's a journey to the peak of agile leadership where every minute is a chance to change the game.
And we only have those 24 hours in a day. So it's very important that we kind of own the day, or it will own you.
Every business owner has 24 hours in a day. How we choose to use it is the difference between a mediocre business and a highly successful business. Our next guest is Angela Johnson, the CEO and certified Scrum trainer at the Collaborative Leadership Team, and the author of The Scrum Master Files, Secrets Every Coach Should Know. We discuss why, if everything is priority, nothing is. Strategies for force ranking to-do lists, the importance of making these lists visible and transparent, and why focusing on one task at a time trumps the myth of multitasking. We also talk about time boxing and how breaking down tasks into manageable chunks builds the momentum to get stuff done. Whether you're a seasoned business owner or just starting out, this episode is packed with valuable insights and practical tips that will transform the way you manage your time and prioritize your tasks. Join me as Angela shares how to prioritize so that we maximize your impact and efficiency. So prioritization is one of those things that it seems to be simple in practice, but very difficult. Simple in theory, but very difficult in practice. Before we unpack that a little bit, what's got you so interested in this topic around prioritization for leaders?
So, truth be told, it was my foray into Agile and more specifically Scrum. We love that word, prioritize. However, most of us in the United States, I'll pick on my country for a minute, abuse that word. You know, people will say it's all priority. Well, that's not really what that word means. And so the official Scrum guide went so far as to remove the word prioritized and replace it with order, suggesting a force ranking. Something is one, something is two, and so on. And I found personally, when I started practicing what we preach, when I started working exactly the same way we were teaching others to work, how much more I got done from simply focusing. So instead of starting a bunch of things, hang on, let's start finishing and stop starting. So once I started really focusing and getting things complete before the next thing, now you start picking up traction, and now you can become a little more efficient, because there really is no such thing as multitasking. That's a myth we tell ourselves, but you know, the sheer act of focusing stopped that context switching and the wasted time.
Tell us a bit more about this myth of multitasking, because I do hear people say that, you know, I'm a good multitasker. I can do this really, really well. I can do many things at once.
Well, you can speak to a doctor, a medical doctor. You can speak to a psychiatrist, a psychologist.
I just need to stop you there. I'm not one of those people, all right? So I probably need a doctor for many other things, but not for that one.
But people who say I'm good at multitasking, I'm like, oh, come on. Because this, you know, the brain is a single-threaded machine. It has to set a task down to pick another one up, which is why in many parts of the world, trying to text and drive at the same time is illegal. You're physically not capable of doing multiple tasks at one time. And there's a whole slew of studies. The most notable one that comes to my mind is 1992, Dr. Jerry Weinberg. He published his famous context switching study, which showed by the time you're on five simultaneous projects, 75% of your time is just lost in figuring out what the heck you're supposed to be focusing on. There's modern studies. University of London actually did one recently, and they broke it down by gender. But I have bad news for you, since you're male. The men are faring worse than the women. It's actually affecting their IQ. Women, not as much, but still, it's dropping. So it's certainly not making us smarter, because they chose, in addition to measuring productivity, to measure IQ. And Forbes also recently published a study on this topic. So it's a hot one, but we're not getting smarter. We're actually losing IQ when we try to multitask.
I've actually written on my notes, I was going to ask you about the male versus female thing, because you do hear that, and again, females say it, like I've, females are better at multitasking. My wife is certainly better at multitasking. We know that's not a great thing to do, but she seems to be able to manage that thing better than what I can do. Is there something, what is it about the, do you know anything about the sort of male versus female as to why that is the case, even though we're saying multitasking is not the right thing to do?
For sure. Digging into the study, which is not the most exciting read, but if people would like to, it's out there. It's got something to do with the appearance of how fast we make the switch. So if you're switching from task A to task B, that there, you're not doing them both simultaneously. You're literally putting one down to be able to pick up the other one. Women seem to be appearing to do that switch more quickly, which gives the facade or the illusion that they are multitasking, when in reality, they are context switching. They are not doing both at the same time. They're not losing as much because they make that switch faster than men do.
Are you able to share a little bit more, if you do know a bit more of the detail? You said earlier around in Agile and Scrum, they removed the word priority and changed to order. It's such a subtle change, but geez, it seems so powerful in my head. What brought this about?
Yeah, and other countries that speak English, because I say, you know, we're not the original English-speaking country out there. If you look at the word priority, the root is prior, which means something is prior to something else. And I remember when they made the change, there were a number of my colleagues who also do certified Scrum training, who are located in London and other parts of Europe, and they were just frustrated. Because they're like, it's because those of you in the US don't understand English. You know, prioritized literally means something is prior to something else. Like, well, I guess we just don't understand English in this country, because it is a common Americanism to say it's all priority. And that's simply not true. And so the word order was the one they chose to get people to start force ranking, to say, no, something has to be one, something has to be two, something has to be three. It all can't be priority or nothing is.
I love it. I've never heard that before, and I do love it. I think I might have to start to change my language around that as well to order. It just makes perfect sense. What is it about this multitasking phenomenon that is not really a phenomenon, it's just a waste of time completely, that people get the buzz from it? Like, why do people think that it is such a good way to go when actually they probably do know that it's not a great way to go? Like, what's in the psyche that drives that?
If I adopt the persona of a leader or a manager, because I guess, you know, we could even talk about the fact that there's managers versus leaders. So if a manager isn't necessarily trusting people and they want to make sure that they're busy the entire time, that they have enough work, they may endeavor to have them fully utilized. And so they may want to stack them up. So that's what I keep hearing from organizations. We want to do more with less. The reality is they're not getting more done. They're probably getting less done than if the leader or the manager gave a clear direction and allowed people to start finishing instead of starting a bunch of things. The other thing that I try to impress managers about this fallacy of multitasking is the notion of giving people a built-in excuse. That usually wakes them up a little bit. It's like, what? Well, you gave Brendan 4 different projects. Which one's the most important one? Well, they're all priority. So Brendan gets to guess. Brendan gets to guess which thing he's going to work on. Well, he knows it's all got to be done. So you ask Brendan for a status on project A, and he says, so sorry, I was working on B. Hey, how is B going, Brendan? Well, you know, I'm late for a meeting on project C. I'll have to get back to you. We don't like that. You've given them a built-in excuse. Who knows what's really going on? We want to believe the best in people, of course. But when you give people clear direction and we know what the priority is, what the first order of business is, there's no excuses. You've got kind of this radical transparency about where things are at.
Yeah, so clear again. How do you help create order? How do you determine what should be 1, 2, 3, 4?
Super contextual, which is a fancy way of saying it kind of depends on the environment you're in. Now, I'm in a services business. And so our services business is very, very student-focused, customer-focused. And we also have a brick-and-mortar event center that I'm sitting in right now. So we license space out to people who want to hold their training events in person. Such a crazy idea, right? And so we're very events driven. So what kind of trumps everything in my own team's ordering of work, is it guest facing? Is it student impacting? Is it revenue driven? Because that drives our world. Nextly is the calendar, you know, because if we have an event on the calendar, we can't really do anything about the fact that the date is here. Or likewise for a training class that's been scheduled, people have made plans. So those pieces of input tend to impact my business greatly, right? Calendar, money, student, guest facing. Now, if I talk to somebody in a financial industry, we might get a totally different answer. They might bring up things, at least in the United States, about regulatory compliance. They may bring things up about money, what the market's doing. I know our healthcare system is, you know, often something other countries just don't understand. And sometimes, honestly, I don't either. But, you know, we definitely have a couple of different levels of regulatory compliance that come into play. If it's healthcare, you know, HIPAA for the privacy laws, insurance classifications, all of those things can come into play. And a common thing I hear is return. Well, return on investment. What do you mean? Is it money generating that goes into the highest valued items, or is it cost saving? And then sometimes I hear people say it's a bit of both. So it really depends on the industry you're in and the type of business you're in. So it's not a one size fits all. There will be all these factors that go into coming up with the order.
And can you share with us a little bit of your own sort of thoughts and experience in, let's say there's a business owner, a leader who has a team of people, and it's, how do you determine the priority in the business? Or it might be a team further down within the business. What's the process of determining what's important, which then, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, that will help lead into what's the right order, let's say, for that team?
Well, we use these really advanced techniques called talking to each other. In the Scrum and Agile community, you know.
That sounds very advanced.
Isn't it advanced?
Angela?
Just, we're going to talk to each other. And we're going to talk about all those different factors. So from a business perspective, customer facing, time to market, all that happy stuff. Well, now you said team. So the team who's actually going to do the work, they are probably going to weigh in. Because unbeknownst to the business, there may be some dependencies. There may be some technical aspects of doing exactly what they want, but they just don't know. So they may say to the business owner, to the product owner, did you know what you have in number three physically can't be done until we do this thing that's down here in number seven? Oh, I did not know that. So of course, it's going to be this collaboration and we can reorder. So it's not that dictatorial that once it's out there, we can't change it. Of course, we can adapt, right? We were talking at the beginning of this session about adapting. Oh, we're all adapting these days. Of course, we can adapt.
So I get that. Sounds very scientific, this whole talking thing. Is the real problem potentially that it's not that people don't know how to order, it's that they're not spending time talking together in order to create a foundation for order?
I think so. Sometimes I think we make a lot of assumptions. There's a popular acronym. This is not, you know, my creation. It's a popular acronym out there called HIPPO, which stands for Highest Paid Person's Opinion. So a number of organizations will simply order the work based on who's screaming the loudest or who's got the biggest paycheck or the highest rank in the organization. And their opinion is what drives the order. The bummer there is that they may have great opinions, but they're just that. They could be the furthest away from our users or our customers and have no empathy for what really is going on. Not that they don't have good ideas, but they have to understand that their input is input. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be the final answer once we weigh all the different factors from all that talking that we need to do.
Let's now just say that I'm an individual, a micro business owner, and it might have contractors in place here and there for different loads of work. And this is a conversation I had last week just with a friend of mine. What do you suggest to them in order for them in their own sort of task management, order management, how they start to move themselves ahead to know that they're spending time and they're ordering the right things for their own business and for their own day-to-day activities? Because that's where, to me, that's where a lot of the, apart from this talking thing, there seems to be a lot of problem just on the ground where people are, you know, getting into that busy fight or flight sort of thing, and they're not taking some time to determine, well, what am I want to do for my business? How do I want to get there? And then what do I need to focus on? What do you say to people around that space?
And you mentioned contractors. So are you saying that these organizations are doing work for hire, like they're doing work or an end customer, like maybe they're building a website or maybe they're building an app or something?
Absolutely,
like
that. Absolutely. Yeah, they may bring someone for a certain project type thing that they need worked on.
And one of the things I really like about the agile approach known as Scrum for that, right? You probably recognize the scrummage, right? A rugby-like approach there, is if they do that, if they can hold some sort of refinement conversation, which is talking with that client, and they can agree on that ordered backlog, then they can assess in whatever the time frame is, and it's popular in Scrum to use sprints. So if a services-based organization, let's say it's building a website for a client, so they get their marching orders from the client, well, rather than wait until 3 months, 6 months has gone by, why don't they check in at the end of every sprint, let's say 2 weeks? Because now the client can review more readily, and then they can adapt from sprint to sprint based on what's going on. They really want to take this talking stuff to the next level. There is a daily scrum. There's a 15-minute or less check-in every day. Well, the client's the one paying the bill. The client's the one giving the input, and that's who's going to take the deliverable. Why couldn't that client hop on a Zoom call or Microsoft Teams call with the contracting firm, with the implementer, for 15 minutes or less every day just to be available to answer questions or to adapt if we're not headed in the right direction? There's too many horror stories out there. I'm sure you have experienced even the end of a long project, having a customer go, that's not really what I meant. That's not really what I wanted to do. And then you start talking about things like change requests and people aren't happy for spending more time and more money.
Tell us a bit more about the agile. Talk more about how the process would work in order to create the order for a team of people? What sort of structure should you have in place? You mentioned some of it there about the certain meetings and talking and that sort of stuff, but how does that framework work for you given your Agile and the Scrum background?
So we talk in a refinement conversation, and how often we talk depends on how often we want to make change. My own organization is a bit fluid because we are a services organization and not work for hire, like somebody hiring us to build a piece of software or a website or anything like that. We deliver training classes, coaching, so those kinds of services. So we choose to work in a one-week time box that we call a sprint just because the calendar drives our world. We do a 15-minute or less daily to check in with each other so we can adapt. But we do a new planning every 5 days, which gives us a lot of flexibility to be able to adapt to whatever's happening with our client base, the market, the calendar. But it's pretty popular out there in the world of work to do a 2-week or a 10-day sprint. So that refinement conversation about what's coming up in the future might be held more frequently for a company that's going to do a little bit longer sprint than a company like mine that is adapting from week to week. So let's say you've got something you're going to deliver and the time frame is 3 months, like one quarter. You might hold a couple hours of refinement with the people who are involved, the team doing the work, the person who's going to own the work. They're going to invite business players, subject matter experts to that conversation. And so they might do enough to get the order, the top of the list, really solidified so that people can start working in the sprints. But then we have to stay ahead. We have to stay like 2 to 3 or more of those time boxes ahead of where the team is working. So there's going to be those ad hoc conversations carved out on their calendar to continually talk about, here's what's coming next, here's what's coming next, which gives us the maximum ability to be agile, right? If we like the E word there, to adapt more readily.
How do our, let's just take a standard workplace, whatever that basically means, but I think this sort of agile is not as common as probably what you'd like to have in organizations. Meeting discipline and structure, and that's probably not as common in my experience in organizations generally, and I think that's globally as well in my own experience. What is it about the standard workplace that either contributes or detracts from this ability to order in a good way and therefore create a level of productivity and efficiency that I think it's fair to make the claim that it seems to be lacking, irrespective of what country you sit in?
Right. I think it's a lot of death by meeting. I think there's not the fact that these conversations aren't going on. I don't think these conversations are as productive as they could be. And when you think about a classic connotation of meeting, think about the words people even use. So we say meeting. Okay. What's the agenda? What are the action items for after? Oh, so we're literally saying no work is getting done in this conversation. Sounds like a wasted opportunity, sounds like a lot of wasted time. So the events that we have in something like an agile approach called Scrum, the reason they go out of their way to not say the word meeting is because these are roll up your sleeves working conversations. So right there in the conversation, as somebody is saying, that doesn't make sense to have this item before the other one, because it physically doesn't work that way. Oh yeah, let's reorder that. So you're physically capturing the results of the conversation in the order of the work, the detail that we all just learned from the knowledge acquisition, the messiness of talking to each other. And now we leave all on the same page. Because I think classic workplaces have death by meeting. All this stuff happens after. And we shuffle documents or we send links to each other. You know, here, I'll send you the link to where the document is, just go read it. Well, that's discouraging collaboration. That's like literally telling somebody, go away and just read it. Well, you're assuming that's going to happen. And you're also then assuming they understood it exactly the way it was intended. And we can completely misinterpret the written word. So the agile approaches, Scrum in particular, puts the emphasis on people talking to each other first. Then we write down our shared understanding so that there is no question. So instead of, you know, discouraging collaboration and shuffling people around to shared documents, which doesn't equal shared understanding, we have these actionable, productive conversations. So not this death by meeting and wait for everything to happen after.
And I'm assuming you do know the Patrick Lencioni book, Death by Meeting, because that's a fantastic read. And this is what I find really difficult to understand. Everything you're telling me makes perfect sense. A lot of it I'm involved in working with my own clients. I spent over 20 years in the corporate space, and I can't talk highly enough about that because that's allowed me to do what I do today in my own business and work with great people. But what I find absolutely fascinating, and I don't know why, because there's so many people that know this, talk about it, but don't do it. I never, ever had a development session on how to run one-on-one meetings better. I never, ever had a development session on how to do coaching for people in my team or you know, coaching myself or coach up. I never, ever had conversations or training around how important responsibility is in leadership and taking responsibility for your own actions and those sorts of things. Like there was just all this stuff that we know that can contribute to better workplaces. It's not like you and I are the only people that know this. Like, it's well known around the world. So many people, but what I find hard to understand, I don't know why it doesn't happen. I had over 20, almost 25 years in the corporate space, and not one time. A lot of this stuff I learned through doing lots of crazy, stupid, you know, unknown things. I didn't know what I didn't know, but then I learned through my own self-reliance.
Right.
What's your experience? Please tell me. Help me understand. Can you help me understand, Angela? Because I am lost, and it's a big reason why we do a podcast like this, because it just seems so basic.
I will answer you exactly the way I answered one of my students recently. They said, this is so simple. This is so simple. Why don't companies just do this? And I said, it's really simple to be healthy, isn't it? All you need to do is eat right. Eat 5 servings of vegetables a day. Cut back on the lean meat, put down the treats. All you need to do is exercise 30 minutes a day, average 5 days out of your 7-day week. That's really, really easy to do, isn't it? And he goes, oh, I... simple doesn't mean easy.
No, it doesn't.
So this stuff sounds really simple, but when it gets right down to changing it, oh, you know, as humans, it's like, change. Oh, yeah, I'm not really ready for the change. I don't really want to change. So we just tend to procrastinate. So I think, you know, simple doesn't mean easy. I think we fall into our rut in our organizations, and it takes something pretty extraordinary to get people to actually change. And I think it starts at the top.
Agree. It starts at the top. And supposedly people higher up in the, this may sound worse than what my intent is, but supposedly people at the top are, you know, the higher up the tree, the more driven they are, the more focused they are on improvement, you know, driving results, hopefully in themselves and the organization. So it would seem like the impetus for that change, for that development would be at the top. But again, it's not.
I think there's a lot of assumptions going on at the top, at least with the leaders I'm talking to right now. I think they're so busy. They don't focus. They don't have this clear order. And so their world goes in buzzwords, like, you know, buzzword bingo. They look at tweets. I don't know if we can call it that anymore, X's, whatever, headlines, these snappy little headlines. And they read a buzzword in Gartner, and then they tout it as if it's just happened. And we could even use Agile as an example, because I pick on the A word a lot, even though that's what I do for a living. A CTO I recently was talking to, Agile, agile, agile. I mean, just every other word in this conversation. And I said, I am so sorry. Could you tell me what you mean by agile? And he said, well, I thought you were an agile coach. I said, yes. And that is why I'm so confused right now, because that could have meant 7 different things back in the year 2001. But in the year 2023, it means about 100 different things. What do you mean? And he said, I mean, Scrum. Great. Whose version of Scrum? And he goes, no, Scrum is just Scrum. I said, no, it's not. In 2003, there was one version of Scrum. In 2023, there's like 10 different versions of Scrum. And he's like, oh my God. I had no idea. I just told everybody to do this. Are you surprised why they're confused? He's like, no. So we need to have a conversation with each other. The leader has to slow down and decide what the first thing is and what the second thing is before they go marching along, making an assumption and not knowing. Because then that really gets to their credibility or their lack of credibility when they wonder why things aren't just working, when they make these, you know, these edicts from the top without really knowing what they're saying.
And how do they slow down? What do you tell them? Because I know the pushback is about, it's like, I've got so many things to do. I've got this I've got to do, even when they're the owner of the business. This, I've got to do this, I've got to get that. And so how do you get them to slow down? What do you get them to do?
Read, copy, you know, because if we don't read, we're renting ideas from somebody else. And I even tell them, don't do that, not even for me. I want you to read. And so even in short conversations, I'll put a paragraph in a document out of the official Scrum guide or out of the Agile manifesto and say, just read this. The minute they slow down and read, now they're starting to process. Now they're starting to own the idea for themselves rather than just, you know, learning about it from somebody like me. The other thing, and this may sound like a bit of a Yoda-ism at the end of a long day for you and I, but we all have 24 hours. How we choose to spend it is different from person to person. Beyonce has the same 24 hours in a day that I do. We make very different choices. I can assure you of that. You know, so what are you choosing to spend your time on? That's the big question for them to answer, because we all have choices.
We absolutely do. And how do they make the right choice, in your opinion?
So the company's probably got goals and objectives. And if we're being really honest, there's probably something that they are incented by. It's probably in their plan or their package or whatever. And this gets into how the leader is incented. You know, if it's a publicly traded company, sometimes there's shareholders or a board for them to answer to. And privately held companies like mine, there's a little bit more freedom. They can really say, this is the 3-year plan. This is the 5-year plan. This is the trajectory of where I want to go. Well, that shouldn't just be fluff. Whatever that plan is should be an input to driving everything else. And I'll give you an example from a CIO I worked with a number of years ago now, but he is the one who just popped into my head. Because all I kept hearing about when I got there was all of these projects are priority. All this stuff is priority. Well, no surprise, nothing was getting done. And he loved to speak in bullet points. He was the master of it. And he would talk about these 5 initiatives that the company had for the year. So I said, here's your homework before our next conversation. I want you to go around to every team in your IT department. And it was a small privately held company. He had 90 people in this information technology group. So pretty doable. So I said, go around to each team and I want you to ask them, what are your top 5 initiatives for this year? So when we met, I said, do you have the same 5 initiatives that you've been telling everybody is priority? He goes, no, I don't. There's a list of about 45 different things. So it's no surprise that we're not meeting the company's goals and objectives because everybody's pulling in these different directions. What would happen if those really were the top 5? And the teams were focused, and this gets into the Scrum and Agile stuff, but if we formed teams around each of those initiatives, what would happen then? And that was the beginning of them calming down and focusing and starting to order the work instead of it's all priority.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we don't provide this order, then people will make up their own order. And all of a sudden you've got the arrows going in all sorts of different directions, haven't you?
I would say it's like letting them guess. Well, I hope they guess right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I don't know about your experience. My experience is most people wake up and actually I'm classic for saying this. Most people wake up and nobody wakes up in the morning wanting to do a bad job. Right. So, you know, I don't get up every morning thinking I can't wait to do a bad job today. I'm sure you don't do that. I haven't met anybody that does that. But they're focusing on things that they think they should do as opposed to they know they should do, which contributes to their role, contributes to the business outcomes and objectives and all that sort of stuff.
They have good intentions. Of course, we all have good intentions.
Absolutely.
But if it's not made clear what we should be working on, yeah, we might guess wrong.
What would you say to the point that I come back to a bit is that as leaders, I'm talking very, very generically here, as leaders, we seem to be looking for the smart rather than the effective, the simple and effective, because that's what seems to me the undercurrent of, you know, prioritization. We're looking for smarter ways. Surely it can't be that simple, Angela. It's not that simple. But it is, like, it is simple, but like you said, it's very difficult in practice. I get that. But what would you say about this? We seem to be looking for smart. We're not looking for simple and effective.
And one of the things when you say that, I have a client that I went through this whole prioritization exercise with. The CIO was just, I can't believe in this day and age, she says, that small companies are working in a lot of things. And I agree with her. My small company works on an enormous number of things, but it doesn't happen from taking each one of us and saying, Angela, your time sliced across these six different initiatives. So you're going to allocate pieces of your time. That's the myth of multitasking. That's at the heart of all those studies we talked about earlier that contributes to the context switching and nothing's getting done. The sheer act of letting a person focus and then ordering the work not only allows them to finish and grab the next task, item, whatever you want to call it, over time, what the data shows, they actually start performing faster because of the sheer act of focusing. And so it gives the appearance that they're smarter. What are you all doing where you're getting so much done? But this other organization that's making people chase work doesn't understand. That is kind of what I think is the secret sauce. And even organizations that aren't going to abandon their classic project management way of working that I've talked to get kind of excited about that notion of having stable teams with clear direction instead of making people chase work, bringing the work to the people in the ordered manner. And sometimes I kind of will say, isn't that an effective leader's job? So if they're doing their job as intended, now everybody in the organization is pulling in the same direction and we're more likely to meet goals and objectives than pulling against each other and saying, oh, well, good luck.
It sounds a bit like what you're saying to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that momentum has a big part to play in that.
It does.
So if you're breaking these things down, the momentum, and maybe you can talk to that momentum and the importance of breaking down tasks, ordering tasks, but at a level that is feeling like achievable. I can achieve this success today or tomorrow, as opposed to saying, even back to your example of reading a book, I've got no time, Angela, like of this. Okay, you don't need to read the book in one day, but just read for 5 minutes in a day.
Right.
You could be sitting on the toilet, pick up that book and read. There's 5 minutes. Don't take your phone into the toilet, as an example. Talk to that a bit.
And there's this element of time boxing that goes along with it. And so one of the things that's really demotivating that I would say is a momentum killer is a big daunting task. Like let's read a book in a day. Or he's like, I got to have this thing done by the end of the week. Well, we know all about the term paper syndrome, don't we? We know all about procrastinating and then wanting to pull an all-nighter, you know, the night before. It's like, if we could just break things down. And in the Scrum framework, the suggestion is to break things down into one day or less chunks so that when we have that 15-minute or less daily conversation, I can say towards our overall goal, here's what I accomplished since we last met. Here's what I'm going to focus on today, or here's where I need help. That's so much more motivating than, oh, I'm still working and I didn't get anything done. What? Well, now not only is that demotivating, we have lower visibility. We have lower transparency. What if somebody could have helped? So But we won't know if somebody could help because it's this big blob of, well, I'm still working on that thing. Well, wait a minute. Where are you stuck? What are you really doing? I can even use a new workshop for my own team, right? Because sometimes you think people who teach this stuff are so good at it. Sometimes we fall off the
Only sometimes.
Yeah, we were working on a new workshop. And one of my colleagues had this big blob out there, just this big task with the name of the workshop. And every day it was, you know, oh, I'm still working on it. I'm still working on it. And one day I said, what would you tell a client right now? What would you ask a client? He's like, well, I'd drill into it. And I'd want to, you know, encourage them to break it into smaller chunks. Like, where's the table of contents? Or where's the learning objectives? Or what about just one exercise? And then I just looked at him and he goes, oh. Gotta drink our own champagne here.
It is outside of Agile and Scrum, are there any other, I guess, methodologies, if we put it into that bracket, that you feel is effective also for helping people if they wanted to look into, just get a bit more structure around this topic of breaking things down, spending time talking, getting some focus, getting some clarity, getting some alignment, and then just thinking through that process of breaking this down to a task?
I don't know that there's necessarily a methodology per se, but one of the things that the world loves is kind of four box models, you know, like a square cut into four, you know, squares. And you can put two variables against two variables.
A bit like your background here for YouTube watchers.
What's that?
A bit like your background for YouTube watches, nice little squares coming around.
Yeah, just pick four of these squares, right?
Absolutely.
And
well done for setting that up, Angela.
And didn't even realize that's what I was doing. Yes, lots of squares. And so what we talked earlier about it being contextual, if people are struggling with where to start, they could take any two variables that make sense and pit it against another two variables. So let's say that one of them is value that they're going to get. You know, this is really high value work. They could pit that against risk. So we've got risk and value, high and low. So now we can use, you know, the four boxes to say, well, if it's high value, but it's high risk, I should really start there. Because if those risks aren't realized, yay me, I can pull the next thing in. But whoopsie, if those risks do happen, well, I have the maximum amount of my time and my money to recover. You know, because the inverse of that doesn't work. Some people will say, well, I'll do high value, lower risk. Yes, but you are spending time and you are spending money. And it's really hard to get those things back. You could do it with customers. You could say new customers that we want to attract and existing customers, pit that against new product, existing product. You know, so you could create a little matrix that way too to help you. So four box models are ridiculously popular, I think, because they're simple and it could really be whatever variables make sense to you. Another concept, if we don't like boxes, if we want to go to circles, a colleague of mine, Dr. Harvey Robbins, who wrote The New Why Teams Don't Work, he calls it a plate. And he says, right, when you talk about ordering work, that it's unethical to keep piling on someone's plate because sooner or later, stuff is going to drop off that plate. So he will talk about center of the plate being most important, middle of the plate, not quite as important, but still on there. Edge of the plate, you should really be questioning whether this is worth your time or not. And then something inevitably has to drop off if it's not going to add any value, it's not really important. But he calls it plate management, you know, instead of thinking about a four-box model.
I like the plate management. What I throw to straight away, though, is it sounds like a lot of people would just get a bigger plate.
Of course you'd think of that, right? It's like, nope, this is the plate. This is the constraint.
So that's it. There is no option for a bigger plate. Something has to fall off.
Something has to fall off, right? I always say, delete that item or delete that task. And people, well, what if somebody comes back and wants it? I'm like, you know what a surefire way to find out if it's important to somebody? Delete it. Because if nobody says anything, there's our answer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the old report writing scenario in corporate, isn't it? You hear this often, that do this report, no one ever gives me feedback. How about you just stop it for a bit and then still no one gives you feedback? No one's even looking at it.
Reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. How important is valuing your own time in relation to this topic of prioritization?
I think it's important, greatly important. I used to take my time for granted, but what I realize is people will take you for granted, right? If you're just giving your time, and we only have those 24 hours in a day. So it's very important that we kind of own the day, or it will own you. I sit by myself for a good 5-10 minutes every morning, just going through like what's on my plate for the day. So calendar driven, of course. Like I mentioned to you, I had a workshop today. Well, okay, I know when that's happening. It's happening between noon and 3 Central Time, which means I only have so much time in the morning, and I only have so much time after the workshop. So now I've got to think about things that can be accomplished in that time or less, you know, so that I can stay focused. And then, of course, talking to my team when they get in and finding out if I'm needed and if anything has to get shuffled in that regard. So I think that it's really, really important that we value our own time, because we only have so much of it.
Yeah, 24 hours, as we said. I want to be respectful of our viewers on YouTube and our listeners on all the platforms' time. I know they value this time listening and watching to this, but what have we not talked about in this conversation that we really need to talk about?
The time is a great segue, because I would say time boxing. You know, for example, when I started working this way, and if you don't want to call them sprints, you can just call them time boxes, that's fine. You know, it's amazing how much the time box forces you to focus. And so when I started doing that, when I started time boxing, I became very, very disciplined. And now it's kind of scary what I can accomplish when I have 5 minutes of focused time. You could give me an hour and keep interrupting me and throwing more things at me, and I'm never going to be as productive as I am if I have focused time. And so when you think about something like Scrum or its cousin, Extreme Programming, because it also has an iteration for a time box, if an organization really wants to get disciplined with this stuff, coming up with how long the time box is going to make them pretty powerful in terms of how often their world changes, how often they want feedback, and how often they want to improve. Because every single sprint gives us an opportunity to change direction for the product. It also gives us an opportunity to talk about what do we want to improve immediately, not a lessons learned that nobody's going to look at, right? You stick in some report, nobody picks up again. Immediately put into practice. So when COVID hit and our team was forced to adapt, as I'm sure yours was, we had been working in 10-day sprints. We had been working in 2-week sprints. That just felt like death. I don't know about you, but our days started to feel like weeks. It was just weird.
Things moved quickly.
It was so crazy what was happening with time. So the suggestion on our own team was, let's go down to a 5-day sprint, which is going to give us, in a 52-week year, that gives us 52 opportunities to adapt, 52 opportunities to respond to change, and 52 opportunities to improve. So if a company says to me, well, we want to do, you know, a 2-week sprint, and I talk about why, I point out, well, in a 52-week year, 2-week sprints, that's 26. So you now have 26 opportunities to respond to the feedback, 26 opportunities to change your course, and 26 process improvement opportunities. Is that enough? Because if they say no, well, then let's talk about a shorter time box. People are so scared of the shorter time box, and I'm a fan of the shorter time box because it forces us to be more disciplined.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just another way of looking, what I'm thinking, looking back at the how we talked about, you know, big task here and breaking that down into bits where you're doing the same with the time, with the ability to be agile and adjust around things, which, again, makes a lot of common sense. How do you minimize distractions in this focus time?
Right. I mean, you and I both have children, right? You know what?
distractions right there.
Right. Exactly. Door shuts.
Good distractions.
Yes. They're very good distractions. These, you know, headphones totally need, you know, those, because even though we have this great little sound barrier in my room, I can't control what's going to happen outside that window. Sure enough, you know, I'll get on a conversation like this one and a lawnmower will fire up right outside the window. So these are so helpful. Plug right into the mic. So I've got kind of this closed loop thing. But heads down time. My own team has heads down time. People will literally mark it on the calendar so that we know this time is when you don't interrupt each other. We also, from a working agreement standpoint, have really adopted, because we're usually wearing headphones or earbuds or something like that in the office, not assuming that somebody's listening. And we have started to even say, can I interrupt you? Is this a good time? And if somebody says no, it's respected. And then, you know, we've got the times when we can see our fair game on the calendar versus times that are kind of blocked off for focused time. Because you just got to do it. And I know a lot of people are officing out of their home. They don't have the luxury of going into an office like I do. Doors. Everybody, you know, remodeled their homes to these open concepts, and now they're all regretting it.
Yeah, they wish I had a few more doors. I wish I had a door in my office too, actually, but another story. And I imagine in what you've just explained, that scientific term you mentioned more at the top of the show, talking.
That's it.
You and your team have probably talked around creating some norms, if you want to call it that, around this is how we, as a team, as individuals, like to create focus time so that we can get that deep work, that real work that we do need to focus on done. And that, again, because you've set that up, that's respected. Is that a safe assumption to say you've used that classic scientific term talking and actually applied it?
Yes, and we call those norms working agreements. The other advantage I think we have of being in an office is there are times when somebody, because we have a big open team area where there are no walls, there are no doors, somebody will get up and go into a private office like this one with a door because we have our own event center that has those things. And they will literally say, I just need some heads down time. I'm going to be in this room down the hall should anything come up, but I really need the heads down time. But that goes into those norms and the courage for people to have that kind of relationship with each other. I don't think those are bad things. You know, I've heard them called norms, social contracts. We tend to call them working agreements in the Agile community, but I think those are needed. I think those are definitely needed, probably more so if your team is distributed and not face-to-face every day.
If I gave you three slots, three bullet points, back to your friend who loves bullet points, if I gave you three bullet points that you could use to give advice to people watching this, listening to this, around how to better prioritize, or I should use the term better order now, what would you say?
Everything can't be priority or nothing is. Something has to be one, something has to be two, something has to be three. So just get your pen and paper out and start ordering it and start time boxing. Start giving yourself the freedom to say, I'm going to spend this many minutes on it. And it's okay at the end of that time box to say, I'm going to need a little bit more or not, but you can adapt from there. So we've got to get busy finishing and not starting a bunch of other things.
I like it. There is some research around about, as individuals, we have so many things in our life. I can't remember the numbers of unfinished stuff. Like we take things to a point. It might be in our house. It might be there's some renovations happening and we just haven't painted that door yet, and that completes the renovation and stuff. So, yeah, I don't know if you know anything about that and think about your own life, but that alone just builds up stress and anxiety, doesn't it? Having these things that are unfinished in our life,
right,
whether it's work-related or personal-related.
Totally. And I used to get into the Strengths Finder. I don't know if you're familiar with that, you know, your top five strengths, and for years, my number one was Activator. And, you know, you talk about copying without knowledge. I'd be like, oh, Activator, that sounds like I get a lot of stuff done. Well, I met with a StrengthsFinder coach and they're like, that's not what that means. Activators are really good at starting a bunch of things. They're terrible at finishing them. So that was a big wake up call. I need to start finishing some things and not start so many things.
Well, now's a good time, I think, to bring us to our last question, which is, Angela, what's helped to make you become a more confident leader?
My failures, but by far and away my failures. You know, you've mentioned a couple times, hey, this stuff all sounds so simple. And I said, yeah, that doesn't make it easy. I think that we learn more from those failures. And I think that in this day and age, it's getting more accepted to talk about that. But I don't think it used to be that acceptable. It's like, oh, here's the secret sauce. Well, hang on. I've not learned as much from doing things right or perfect. I don't even know that there is such a thing. Fail, first attempt in learning. And the learning comes not from the actual failure. The learning comes from reflecting on the failure. And so that's what I attribute a lot of what I know today is from those, making those mistakes, but then having the courage to adapt and recover from them.
Angela, I'm too inquisitive and I just cannot leave it like that. So sorry, apologize for lying. It's not the last question. Tell me what's an epic fail that comes to mind that has given you that reflection and that learning?
Oh my gosh, a huge epic.
Just one.
He goes, just one. Hiring, you know, especially if you have a lot of leaders on the call. I used to hire for just horrible reasons. And I hired somebody who was so toxic and so detrimental to this business. And the reason we hired that person is we thought, well, we don't want to compete against them. So we should hire them, you know, to take them out of the equation. Aren't we so smart, right? Oh, they're playing checkers. We're playing chess. What a bunch of crap. It was the most toxic addition to our team. It was thankfully not very long, but I have got some scars from that. But the team actually amended our own working agreement after we voted that person off the island to say, right? Because our working agreement says we can use humor. We love using humor with each other. But that person would do it in a way that would just twist the knife. You know what I mean? So after we voted them off the island, we amended our agreement to say it's okay to use humor, but not to launch a missile at someone because we're not going to do that again. And I had to really take a step back and think about why am I hiring? Why are we looking at adding somebody? Since I clearly suck at it, let's have everybody on the team interview this person next time, right? Interview people next time so that I'm not blinded by some reason that could be the worst possible outcome for our business. That was a pretty epic fail.
That is, and I think it isn't, no, I know it's an epic fail that I can align with. I've had the same epic fail, or fails, and I know many, many people that I've worked with and just know generally in my network that have had many epic fails with employment, recruitment, that sort of stuff. So there's lots of people hearing you and probably sharing the same pain.
Well, there's comfort in that.
Absolutely. The really interesting thing, Angela, and we've not said this, I have not said this on the podcast before, but in 2024, we're a few months away from 2024, but we are actually launching a sister podcast to the Cultural Leadership, which will be called My Worst Leadership Moment. And it's based on exactly that sort of stuff that you talked about, learning from experiences of others. So getting our guests to share their experience, what was their sort of epic fail or their epic challenge in the leadership context, explaining that, unpacking that a bit, what they took from it and how it's impacted it moving forward. So it sounds like you've already jumped the gun and we'll have to cut that little bit out and chuck it into the whole worst leadership moment.
Use it as a teaser. Use it as a teaser.
No, I think we might have to. I think we might have to. You're a consummate professional, Angela. There's no doubt about it. What does 2024 look like for you? What's on the plate? What do you got coming forward?
We're going to put a lot of emphasis into our center because one of the things that's been a pleasant surprise is even though our own classes have not bounced back for in-person, the appetite is just for virtual and that's okay. Mm. We had always planned on licensing and renting our own space out to other companies who let their own brick and mortar go. And that's been booming, thankfully. So we're going to put a lot of emphasis into that. We renewed our lease for another 3.5 years. And so we're going to be thinking about different ways to pivot in different business professionals. Like today, we had a board meeting here, not just training classes, but all kinds of things. So that's what we have on deck for 2024.
Sounds fantastic, Andrew. Sounds like you're taking some time to think about that, set up the bigger picture and create some order to make that happen. And I sincerely hope that you take the right decisions moving forward and keep working on the right order and getting these things done.
I love that you picked up that word.
It's a good word. It makes perfect sense. It's a lot cleaner than priority. So, Andrew, thank you very much for coming on our show. I love your background. I love the information you've shared today on this interesting, fascinating, simple but difficult topic for people to actually do. It's not difficult to get your head around, I don't think, but like you said, difficult to do. So thank you very much. Really appreciate you, appreciate your time, and you've been a fantastic guest on The Cultural Leadership. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This quote from Stephen Covey aligns perfectly with the underlying message of this episode. The key is not to prioritise what's on your schedule, but to schedule your priorities. These are my three key takeaways from my conversation with Angela. My first key takeaway: confident leaders prioritise talk time. They have conversations with their team members, seeking input to collaboratively set and achieve goals. By dedicating this time, they establish and clarify the order of priorities, ensuring everyone is aligned and focused. My second key takeaway: confident leaders are masters of their time. They make every meeting count, focusing on activities that offer the greatest impact towards their objectives. They're proactive in planning their days, deciding their top three priorities the night before, to ensure their time is spent on what matters most. My third key takeaway: confident leaders minimize distractions. They create environments conducive to focus, like blocking heads down time in their calendar. By setting clear norms and boundaries, such as having designated quiet spaces or agreed upon times for interruptions, they foster a culture where undivided attention is valued and productivity is maximized. So in summary, my three key takeaways were: confident leaders prioritize talk time, confident leaders are masters of their time, and confident leaders minimize distractions. Let me know your key takeaway on YouTube or at thecultureofleadership.com. Thanks for joining me, and remember, the best outcome is on the other side of a genuine conversation.